It's Lars. Thank you for checking out my podcast and have a great day.
Are you approaching retirement, or maybe you've just changed jobs? If so, you'll probably now have control of your 401k or IRA. Would you like to buy some property, notes, loans, start a new business, or even buy crypto? You can with a self-directed IRA. For more than a decade, I've been telling you about setting up a self-directed IRA through IRA Advantage. And while you may now hear other companies say they offer self-directed IRAs, you need to find out if they're truly self-directed. With a truly self-directed retirement account, you can make any investment the law allows. Whether you're talking about true diversification, starting your new business, or investing in private holdings, IRA Advantage through a truly self-directed IRA can make that happen. Take it from me, Lars. You've worked hard for your money. IRA Advantage will work hard to keep it yours.
Would you like to learn more about truly self-directed IRAs? Then visit IRAAdvantage.com. View our videos and call IRA Advantage. That's IRAAdvantage.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to my favorite day of the week, First Amendment Friday. We open up the phone lines, and every subject is fair game. And believe me, I'm going to get to that kid in Seattle who went to his school with a pistol and shot at some of the parked cars there. Thank God nobody was hurt. He was arrested, he was charged, and within a very short while, he was bailed out on $2,500 bail. I know, we're going to get to that in just a moment. It seems as though even when the officials get a really good forewarning of somebody who could be a potential killer, hey, cut them loose on bail. That seems to be what people are doing right now. But first, welcome to the show. Glad to have you on board for a First Amendment Friday. If you've never heard the show before, you know that for 25 years, we've been allowing everybody who wants to sound off to sound off. And if you're a naysayer, you go right to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll. Today's question. The FDA just a few hours ago announced that it has approved vaccine for kids as young as 6 months of age. Now, as you know, there aren't a lot of kids who get COVID at 6 months of age or 1 year or 2 years. In fact, an awful lot of childhood vaccinations don't happen until the child is 12 months of age. But now the FDA has green-lighted this. I'm sure the pharmaceutical crowd is celebrating. They have another place to sell their vaccines. And as you may have heard on this show, you know that literally tens of millions of doses of the vaccines have been tossed. Why? Because they found there wasn't demand for them. So they're going to create some new demand. Would you vaccinate your 6-month-old or 8-month-old or 1-year-old child? That's a question I want parents to carefully consider using all the information you have available to you. Is the risk of COVID greater than or less than the risk, the potential risk? I know it's small, but the potential risk of vaccinating a child that young with something that is still so relatively new, and that we know from the VAERS reports, there are potential problems. So it's a bit like rolling the dice. The chance of something bad happening, very small. The chance of something bad happening from COVID, very small. Which is the greater risk? Which one would you take as a parent? And I'll be glad to take callers on both sides of that one. You can find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, I want to ask you something, a couple of questions I want to ask. Number one, is the number one job of government, especially at the state and local level, public safety? That's question number one. Question number two, is public safety enhanced by the presence of thousands of people here in the Northwest living on the streets, living in tents, living in cardboard boxes or shanty towns? We hear about fires, we hear about shootings, we hear about drug dealing that's all associated, criminal activity that is associated with those homeless camps. Do homeless camps enhance public safety? I would argue they do not. So for about 50 years, in my direct experience, governments have been promising, we've got a plan to end homelessness. It always involves more money, more time, and bad results. I think that is almost uniform across the board. So let me focus in on one government in particular as an example. It is Multnomah County, the single most populous county in the state of Oregon. It's a lot like King County in Washington State, although King County and Seattle have a much bigger population. Multnomah County is about 800,000 people. So the third question I have for you, is it okay with you that Multnomah County spends very nearly 10% of its entire budget on a tiny population of a few thousand people who are living on the streets and provides them with what the county likes to call services that do not include the homeless changing their behavior at all? Now, I know I hear this from callers all the time. Well, when you put it that way, Lars, yes, I want to put it that way. So let me start with Multnomah County. Again, a big county, it has a big budget. This year, the budget is just short of $3 billion. Now, that doesn't even get into the $6 billion that the city of Portland spends, because the city of Portland is almost as big, not quite as big, as Multnomah County. Multnomah County lops over on the edges. Multnomah County has now approved a budget of almost $3 billion, and almost 10% of it is going to go to people living on the streets, the so-called homeless or houseless. They keep coming up with new names. But here's the part that got to me. They have allocated $255 million, more than a quarter of $1 billion, to the Joint Office of Homeless Services. I would swear that the people who run county government right now are smoking joints to come up with stuff like this. And get this, these are the actual numbers from the county. $255 million. And what is their goal with all that money? Their goal is to get 2,700 people off the streets. Now, I'll save you the trouble of doing the math. That works out to $94,000 per person in the new budget year that begins July 1. $94,000 per person. Now, if you're not a homeless person, if you're not drug addicted, if you're not shooting heroin or smoking methamphetamine, if you're not living in a tent or a cardboard box, how much in services does Multnomah County supply to you? The answer is a little less than $3,500. In other words, Multnomah County is going to proposes to spend, they've actually approved the budget, 27 times as much money on every single homeless person as the services it delivers to the other 800,000 people who live in the county. And I want to hear a naysayer who says, well, that's the way we ought to do it. We ought to take this tiny, tiny population. We're going to try and get 2,700 people off the street, and we're going to spend $94,000 in one single budget year, July 1 to June 30th of next year, $94,000 apiece, or 2,700 times as much in services. And I'll tell you something else. Every one of those homeless persons still gets all the services that you get as a regular citizen. So if you add $94,000 plus $3,500, you're pushing up against the edge of $100,000 in services, because the fact that they get all these special services does not mean the county is denying them any of the other services. If a homeless person goes to court, they get those county services. If a homeless person calls 911, they may get sheriff's department services. They get every other service that everybody else gets, only they get 27 times as much service as everybody else. And then the final question that I really want somebody to answer, if they spend this money, do you think it will actually change anything? And one detail you should know, the county proposes to provide these so-called services to the 2,700 they're trying to get off the street. And they've said, and by the way, you don't have to stop shooting heroin. You don't have to stop using cocaine. You don't have to stop using any of the other hard drugs that you're using that probably put you on the street to begin with. No, keep on using the drugs. We just want to give you a nice, warm place to live while you do it. Glad to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. Your calls are welcome. Naysayers go first at 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
Brought to you by Handyman Maintenance Remodeling. You can find them at hmrservices.net. That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey, do you think it would help at all if we explained basic economics to Ron Wyden? You know, the part where when raw materials costs go up, so does the cost of the finished product. For example, when 2x6s and concrete cost more, your brand new house is going to cost more. And when a barrel of oil goes up in price, so does your gasoline and so do oil industry profits. Wyden thinks that oil companies make too much profit, and he has proposed roughly doubling the tax on those companies. Oil companies usually make a profit. If you don't believe me, look the number up. I did it just this week to make sure I had the latest number. The average profit of oil companies in America, 4.7%. So imagine you're running a business, you sell $100 worth of stuff, and you make $4.70. Now, I know when you multiply that by hundreds and hundreds of millions, you make billions of dollars, but it's still 4.7% average margin. Ask anybody who runs a small business if they'd be happy with a 4.7% return, especially when they know that during other times when oil prices are low, you don't make as much money at all. You're kind of like a farmer. You got to make money during the good times because you know there are going to be bad times ahead. And in this country with Joe Biden in the White House, these are bad times for the oil business. They've been told their business is going to be out of business. And they were told that by Joe right before he turned around and begged them to pump more oil. And now when the president creates an artificial shortage of oil in America by canceling pipelines, refusing to lease land, and setting up all kinds of regulatory barriers, that drives up the cost per barrel. So Joe Biden may be personally responsible for an awful lot of Ron Wyden considers excess profits. So what does Wyden propose? Wyden's so-called windfall tax on profits would add 21% in taxes to the current 21% rate. I know, do the math, 42%. And who exactly does the senator from New York City think is going to actually pay those increased taxes? Again, basic economics, the guy or gal at the pump who's buying the gasoline, you're going to be paying those taxes. So while you're emptying your wallet at the pumps to pay almost $6 a gallon for gasoline, Ron Wyden wants the government to up the taxes, increase the cost, and the government gets a bigger share of what you pay at the pump. And his buddy Joe Biden has gone begging to the oil companies, please produce more fuel, after promising just a year ago to put them out of business in about a decade. How do you suppose all of that is going to work out for all of us? And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every single day on the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 and a half years. 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers go first at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Off Twitter, Dave Boschler writes in, Lars, I'm curious if anybody has studied and estimated the potential flood water damage in Portland and Vancouver had there not been dams on the Columbia River. With all the talk about removing the dams, not those on the Columbia River, but those for starters on the Snake River, although I fully expect that the Greenies, once they're done with the Snake River, will move on to the Columbia River. With all the talk about removing dams, Lars, this is a fantastic time to remind people of the many benefits of the dams on the Columbia and Snake Rivers. Power generation, flood control, recreation. And to that, Dave, I would add irrigation and transportation. You almost can't replace what you get from those rivers with the dams and the locks on them. Dave says, I suspect lives, homes, businesses, and properties were saved by water management and storage from all those dams. And Dave, I think you're absolutely right. Our question of the day, and actually John writes in from all the way from Algonquin, Illinois. He says, Lars, the U.S. EPA website shows that the country's total contribution to global greenhouse gases is 15%. It also shows that all U.S. transportation is about a quarter of that amount. The basic math is, 4% of total greenhouse gases. That's the savings if we shut all the automobiles and transportation down. So why does the Biden administration keep driving us down this disastrous road? John, I think the answer is they want to drive America into the ditch. It will fulfill their socialist fantasies. And now today's Daily Grove.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Rogue Conveyors. Go Rogue.
Well, today is such a fat topic Friday that we actually have two grills. So it's a double grill Friday. First grill goes to the Bi-State Bridge Committee. This is this weird government animal that's supposed to figure out how to put a bridge across the Columbia River, even though it turns out their real goal is to put light rail across the Columbia River. Those of you who are paying the tab in Puget Sound and in Portland for light rail already know the billions and billions of dollars that are proposed to be spent. Well, John Lee writes in from Clark County. He follows this very closely, and he said to me, Lars, the TriMet representative today just told 16 lawmakers of the Bi-State Bridge Committee that the cost of extending Max Light Rail could be between $1 billion to $1.3 billion. That is for a three-mile extension of light rail that serves very, very few people. That equates to $430 million a mile. In the failed Columbia River crossing, the light rail cost was $850 million. So we're looking at a 53% increase. You could buy 1,300 double-articulated basic rapid transit buses for $1.3 billion, or you could buy 2,600 city buses. By the way, I think TriMet has less than 1,000 buses. So what he's saying is you could trade 3 miles of light rail track that doesn't serve very many by quadrupling TriMet's fleet of buses. He says only about 4% of people ride transit. Most of those come from the inner city areas. The 2018 PIMCO survey shows that 94% of people prefer their cars. And the second grill, Oregon, and this is told by the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, Oregon's public universities once toothless bans that prohibited people with concealed carry licenses to bring weapons to campus can now be enforced. Does anybody think that's going to make college campuses safer? Because I certainly don't. Our best email of the day, but you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com, is brought to you by Mobile Joe's RV Collision. Get back on the open road and back to your adventure with Mobile Joe's. No body damage, too big or small. Collision or paint repairs, Mobile Joe's RV Collision fixes it all. Thomas Bradley writes in, Lars, it never ceases to amaze me how Democrats can so constantly be stuck on stupid and then amazing enough to double down on stupid. Why weren't oil companies making record profits during Trump? Why wasn't there any gouging during Trump? Obama and Biden have the record for the highest fuel prices ever recorded. Even if we discount for the pandemic, Trump's fuel policies led to low prices versus the bonehead and stupid policies of Joe Biden, which are leading to high prices. Notice that Joe takes no responsibility for his actions. He's a privileged character with a narcissistic mental disorder. He was not going to apologize or take responsibility. He doesn't care. It's time for Republicans to get that through their heads. Coming up in a moment, the Biden administration is pushing hard to get self-driving cars on the road, even as we're hearing new evidence that those self-driving cars are associated with hundreds of accidents. We're going to talk to an expert about it coming up next. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I always disclose, I like to disclose my dog in the fight. I don't own an electric car. I don't own a self-driving car. I've got nothing against the technology. In fact, I think inevitably we're going to go to some kind of either driver assist or self-driving technology at some point in the future. However, I like new technology. I don't like bleeding edge technology where it either costs a lot of money or hurts a lot of people. I'd like the technology to mature as it's ready to mature based on what we know. I also like deregulation. So you wouldn't think I'd be complaining about the Biden administration deregulating and getting rid of a lot of the regulations. But in this case, they're getting rid of the regulations for self-driving vehicles because Joe Biden and his friends want to speed up production of these kinds of cars, even as we're learning that self-driving cars or those with driver assist are showing a rather startling number of crashes. I thought we'd talk about that with a man who used to be the assistant general counsel. That means he was the number two lawyer at Chrysler. He is the current vice president and general counsel for Hillsdale College, which I also admire. Bob Norton, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. I should point out there were a couple of number two lawyers at Chrysler, but yes, I was working for the general counsel, correct.
Well, we're sure that you were the best number two lawyer at Chrysler, and now you're the number one lawyer at Hillsdale, which is a great college, and I could go on and on about that. But I want to talk to you about these self-driving cars. You've got knowledge from the private sector where you are now, or academe. You've got knowledge from your position at Chrysler. Should the Biden, and I've disclosed, I like deregulation, but not all deregulation. In this case, does it make sense, just as we're finding out about 400 crashes of vehicles with partially automated systems in them, mostly Teslas, does it make sense to deregulate them now? Or are we just seeing this being done because of politics in the White House?
Well, I think the NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, realizes that perhaps it had been being too lax, and now they have been trying to at least pay attention more. So there's a standing order that got them the data that's being reported now about how these cars are performing, and I think it is quite a shocking number. I don't think anyone expected there to be hundreds of these crashes. As I understand the report, there were 6 fatalities and something like 15 serious injuries. I think that's a big, much bigger number than they expected to even see.
Well, and when you look, I know that people are going to say, well, there are thousands of crashes in America, but we have 300 million regular automobiles. There are only 830,000 vehicles like this on the roads. And to have 400 crashes, including half a dozen fatalities out of 830,000 vehicles, I have, and we don't know, per mile. I mean, usually they try to make, you try to do an apples to apples comparison by saying, how many fatal accidents do we have per million miles driven? And the number in America is relatively low because the cars have gotten better and better over the years. So why is the Biden administration now pushing to actually get rid of regulation, something that has got to be a little bit odd, because normally Democrats love regulation to death? Is that what you found when you were the top number two lawyer at Chrysler?
Well, they certainly seem to like the regulations, and we had lots of fights for what I thought were very picayune-ish regulations. And traditionally, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has been very loath to approve anything that takes over the driver or is going to in any way possibly impede the safety between the driver and the vehicle. Back in the 90s, I had been defending anti-lock brakes and anti-lock brake systems, and the government came very close to making those illegal because we were taking over for the driver.
I didn't know that.
And telling them, these are safe, look, let us demonstrate this to you. And I was involved in a 3.5-year-long, 3.6 million, I think is what the government FOIA request showed the government spent trying to really defeat anti-lock brake systems at that time. Why is the Biden administration and others so excited about the idea of self-driving cars? I don't have all the answers to that. It seems like one of the issues that's there, not too far below the surface, is a notion about mobility and making mobility a right. And I think we should pay attention to this idea. If it's mobility, and if mobility becomes a right, the government may feel it has the right to enforce these rights and may be doing certain things to help people fulfill these rights that ultimately, I know you're saying you're more of a libertarian, then I think you're going to see the government will ultimately in the end spring into existence saying, let us help you, let us take control of all of these, self-driving cars, because the system they're going to end up working on one way or another will be owned, operated, and controlled by the government.
Now, hold on. Mr. Norton, I don't know your politics, but I suspect if you're at Hillsdale, you're relatively conservative, maybe even libertarian like me. We want the government to take control of something as essential as transportation. The same folks who run Amtrak and the post office and all the other things they do so efficiently and so well.
Right. And by the way, I will self-label myself as conservative. But let's just think about an era not that long ago, say, where there's a national pandemic and many states say you're not allowed to travel, such as in my state of Michigan, where our governor had even forbidden us to drive between other homes you might own. What I'll imagine if the car you're going to drive in or drive be inside of is controlled by an automated system, and if the governor had the ability to hit the stop button and then probably say something like, if you'd like to drive, please just make application to my government and we'll let you know if we think your driving is essential or not.
I could also. I'm sorry, Mr. Norton. Go ahead.
I just said that scares me.
Oh, well, and I could also imagine the day where they say, Bob, you know, you've been driving 400 miles a week, and you say, yeah, because I have things I need to do. And they say, we really think that only about 200 miles of that driving is actually essential. You know, go back to the World War II adage, is this trip really necessary? Do we want a government bureaucrat in D.C. or even a state capital saying, Bob doesn't really need 400 miles a week, he needs more like 300, and be able to artificially limit what you do?
Very good point you make. Cities like London and other cities now, Chicago, are implementing a simple tax for you to be driving in their city during the workday. They collect license plate numbers in London, and they assess a pretty hefty fee to try to discourage you from driving. The notion of rationing, by the way, also comes up in the era of electric vehicles, because we're not going to be able to charge them all at once when everybody gets home from work, say, at even close to the same time. You'll probably be rationed as to when you're allowed to charge your car, if you're allowed to charge your car, especially when you have things like rolling blackouts, very high temperatures across the country, and lots of air conditioning units running for the near term, the foreseeable future, which I think is 20 years out. We don't have anywhere near the electrical grid to support something like that, so you probably would have to ration the amount of charge and when people are allowed to charge their cars. So we should pay attention to some of these technological advancements. They may not, all the glitters may not be gold.
Well, Mr. Norton, you know that one of the big problems with all the alternatives is storage. And I've already heard proposals where they say, we're just going to use, I mean, I don't have an electric car, but if you have one parked in your garage, Lars, we're going to use your car's battery during the night as some of our storage. But we promise it'll be all charged up when you need it. They're already proposing things like that, where they effectively, the government seizes, or the utilities with the government's assistance, seizes your asset and says, we're going to use it. And I'm sure there will be incentives at the front end. And after that, it'll be, you want to own an electric car? You got to let us use the battery as part of our storage for the whole population.
Yeah, you make a logical leap there that I've not made, but perhaps you're right. But you also can see, you were talking about driving too many miles a week. In a future where more of your driving is automated and therefore computerized on the network, you can see even being assessed the tax, right? We'll just give you an excise tax because what you're doing is beyond what we've determined is appropriate.
Yeah, and at that
Michigan,
point,
And in Michigan, like where our governor has shut down restaurants, if you're a restaurant owner and you say, I really need to go out and drive, you could see the governor saying, no, I'm sorry, you know, what you're wanting to do is not essential right now. You're going to stay home.
And I assume, like in Michigan with Governor Whitmer, that the rules will be for thee but not for me. In other words, the elites will still get a chance to do whatever they want to do, go to the French Laundry restaurant or go to their vacation house like Whitmer and her husband did. That's Bob Norton. He is the former second lawyer at Chrysler and now Vice President General Counsel at Hillsdale College. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Will you bring me a gun, please?
Everybody knows Lars loves guns.
I'm a citizen with a constitutional right to bear arms.
And he also loves the Second Amendment. Let's face it, America isn't America without guns.
All right, that does it. It's time to bring out the big guns.
Protecting your right to bear arms every day. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This story out of Seattle involving Mariner High School, which is near Seattle, it really brought to mind a school shooting at Thurston High School in Springfield, Oregon, about 20 years ago. And I'll get back to Mariner High School and what's happened this week, which is a young man is arrested for going to school and in the parking lot at the school firing multiple shots from a pistol into a passenger vehicle in the school parking lot. 15 years old, he's arrested. Then he almost immediately gets cut loose on $2,500 bail. Now, I want to ask you this, but let me tell you the background that this made me think of involving a real school shooting involving human beings who died at Thurston High School in Springfield. And I'll tell you why I think they relate to each other. So virtually everybody who's followed school shootings in America understands that Thurston High, Kip Kinkle, murdered his parents, went to school, murdered some of his classmates, was finally tackled by some very brave classmates, taken into custody. He tried to kill a sheriff's deputy. All of that is history. You say, well, what do I not know about that? What you may not know about that is that in the days before the school shooting, here's what happened. Kip Kinkle had been having problems. Well, teenagers have problems. His mom and dad were happily married. He had a happy home life. In other words, he was sort of the antithesis of the kind of school shooter you hear about, you know, the dark figure who's spending a lot of time online. Well, that wasn't the case back there with Thurston and Springfield at that time. His dad realized he was having problems, so his dad took a year off work as a teacher. I think both mom and dad were teachers. He had a sister. She was away at college in Hawaii, and he got his dad catered to his interest in pistols and rifles, which is okay. Took him to the gun range, taught him gun safety, all the rest of that. At some point, Kip Kinkle obtained a firearm, a pistol. And he took it to school with him. It was not the one. It was not the ones his dad had purchased. And I don't know to this day whether he got it by stealing it or buying it from somebody who stole it or whether he stole it himself. But he got caught at school with the pistol. Now, of course, the school called the police. These days, that might not even happen, given what's been going on in Seattle, where the police show up to an intruder and the school officials won't even talk to the police. And at least initially, the guy got charged with a misdemeanor instead of a felony. He's now charged with a felony. But back to Kip Kinkle. So he gets caught at school with a pistol that he's obtained somehow. And he's turned over to police. His dad goes down and gets him from the police station, takes him home. And I'm reasonably sure he's in some trouble. We don't know because his dad is now dead. So Kip Kinkle goes home with his dad, breaks into a locked cabinet, gets his rifle, kills his dad. Then waits for mom to come home, kills mom, stays up all night long making bombs that he wired to go off because he knew the police would end up coming to his house at some point. He wired the home. Then he goes off to school the next day, and he does the school shooting that he was involved in and is tackled by some of his classmates, and he's put in custody. While he was in custody, he had taped a knife to his leg. This was a murderous little SOB. And the sheriff's deputy or the police officer who took him into custody put him in an interview room and then went off to get a Polaroid camera. They take Polaroids of suspects so that they can't later say that cop beat me up and the marks on my face are from that. So when the officer comes back with the camera, he unlocks the door, goes inside, and Kip Kinkle tries to murder him. He's a bad guy. And you say, well, hold on. When he got caught at school with a gun, why didn't they do something more than what they did? Well, if they had, the school shooting might never have happened. In this case, a 15-year-old male suspect arrested Tuesday of this week for bringing a gun to Mariner High School near Seattle, fired multiple shots into a car. Nobody hurt. He's arrested, he's charged, and he's bailed out on a phenomenally low bail, $2,500. Now, I want to ask you, does that make sense to any of you that this is a warning sign? You know, but for... And who knows at this point? This young man may have had some specific beef. We don't know what motivated him to do what he is accused of doing. And he is only accused at this point. We don't know how the courts are going to treat him, although given the way things are going lately, the courts will probably go very light on him. Most of the courts in Oregon and Washington that used to automatically put somebody who had committed a serious crime into adult court so they could have a record and they could face some real consequences, they're now more inclined to say, we're going to treat this person like a juvenile. And that means later on in life, they may have no criminal record at all, even though they committed a crime as a juvenile. Now, that part doesn't make sense to me either. But releasing him on $2,500 bail, when the minute I saw that story and I saw that he had been released, Katie Davenport put the story up in Seattle, I thought that kid could be another Kip Kinkle. You've had an incident with a gun at school, nobody hurt. You turn the kid loose, and bad things happen down the line. That describes both Kip Kinkle, and it could describe what could happen in this same kind of situation. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. God forbid, we hope it doesn't happen. But I just wonder if we've learned anything about dealing with suspects who bring a gun to school. It's Friday. It's First Amendment Friday. Your calls are welcome at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is First Amendment Friday on the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Our Twitter poll today: now that the FDA has approved it or authorized it, will you vax your kids as young as 6 months? I think it's a serious question that parents have to consider. Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, I want to tell you where you can find the Twitter poll as well, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. And if you're not a big fan of Twitter like me, go to my website and vote there instead. My dog in the fight is that I am a Washington State resident, and I do buy insurance for my car and my house and other things. And I don't particularly care for the state insurance commissioner, Mike Kreidler, for a number of reasons. But now there's a brand new call for him to resign his office, calling him appalling and unacceptable. And Washington State Senator John Braun is leading. I think it's fair to say you're leading that call. Are you not, Senator?
Well, I'm certainly one of many. And frankly, on both sides of the aisle, that say this is unacceptable behavior, that he needs to step down immediately.
Because I think there are a number of reasons he should have been removed a long time ago, not the least of which was going to the legislature and asking for changes in the use of credit ratings to price insurance. And when the legislature told him no, he just went ahead and did it on his own anyway. I think he's been out of control for a while. Now, you may not share my feelings on that, but would you mind describing to the folks listening around the Northwest what he's done lately, or what he's accused of doing that makes it urgent that he leave his office now?
Yeah, so I, like you, have many disagreements with the insurance commissioner. I think he's been wrong on policy, wrong on behavior for a long time. But what he's done now, which is just a few months ago, there were very credible reports of serious misbehavior in his office, the way he was treating staff. That by itself, I think, was enough to call for him to resign.
Bottom was better view.
But now he's gone a step further, and he's actually fired the whistleblower that stepped up and reported that to the public. That should not be acceptable in any circumstance. It's flat-out moral corruption, and we should not stand for it in public office.
Now, Senator, does Washington State have a law that relates to whistleblowers that says, you know, because we understand why somebody who's had the whistle blown on them might want to get rid of somebody, but in many cases, there are laws or policies or rules or ordinances that say you can't retaliate against a whistleblower. Does Washington State have that kind of protection built into the law?
Yes, Lars, we absolutely do. Excuse me. And there's no question that there will be legal outcomes from this ridiculous action by the insurance commissioner. That's going to take some time. But in the meantime, he is no longer fit to be in office. I think that is clear. And the people, not just public officials like myself, pleased to see just in the last few moments that Governor Inslee's actually come out and said he should resign as well. We should not tolerate this, and we shouldn't wait for the legal system to take action. That will happen in due course, but the commissioner needs to resign immediately.
Well, and I'd agree with you on that. The only reason I ask about it is because, am I right in guessing that if Kreidler has violated the law and not only abused some of his employees, but then fired one of the whistleblowers, that when the lawsuit comes, and there will be a lawsuit inevitably, it won't be Kreidler that pays the tab. It'll be the rest of us, won't it?
You're spot on. That's exactly right. In addition to just this being flat out wrong, there's a price to pay. And sadly, it's not Kreidler that pays the price. Excuse me. It's the people of the state of Washington.
Well, I'm sorry you've got a frog in your throat. Believe me, it's a professional hazard for me. But Senator, what muscle does the legislature have? I mean, other than simply a public call for him to resign his office, is there anything else that the state legislature, and now that the governor has joined in, I might actually have to agree with Jay Inslee for a change, and that'll be a pleasant thing to be able to actually agree with him on something. What else can you do to push him out the door?
Well, we're looking into that right now. I think there may be a potential for recall or even I think potentially impeachment. We don't know the answers. At least I don't know the answers to that just yet. But I think we have folks working on that now, trying to figure out the right answer. In the meantime, I'm going to keep insisting everywhere I get the opportunity is that the right thing for Commissioner Kreidler to do is to step down and move on.
Why do you think he apparently feels he's bulletproof? Because, you know, like I said, when you go to the legislature and say, can I do this? And they say no on the issue I mentioned, and you go ahead and do it anyway, and then you behave this way, and then when, you know, the lawmakers and even a Democrat governor are calling for you to step down, you don't, it almost suggests he's got pictures in a safe somewhere of significant people. What makes him think he's going to be able to weather this out?
I think this is, more than anything, is a symptom of decades of essential one-party rule in our state, and some people have let that affect the way they act. They feel, like you say, bulletproof, and they can do whatever they want. They're no longer responsible to the people who elected them, people who put them in office. I think that's the risk when you have, you know, a single party, whether it's this person in particular, or more broadly in our state, in power for a long period of time. And I'm trying not to make this particular issue a political one, because we're working together to try to do the right thing for the state of Washington. But I candidly say it's a symptom of what we've seen in Washington for decades, and we're working hard to change that.
Senator Braun, thank you very much. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. You have a good day.
That is Senator John Braun. Let me get to a naysayer. Don, you're a naysayer. What do we disagree about today?
It's on abortion.
Okay.
I do believe... I just got two words to say on abortion.
Yeah.
Joanne Hardesty.
What does that mean? I mean, Joanne Hardesty. Yeah, she's a despicable public official who should be out of office, and I hope the voters throw her out of office in the November election, but what does that have to do with abortion?
Well, there's a reason for abortion, and she's it.
Well, I'm not going to join you in that sentiment, but thank you for the call. Let's go to John Lee. Hey, John, welcome to the program. I may have to hold you over, but John Lee studies transit issues and lately this billion-dollar bridge that's an excuse for light rail. Thanks for calling in, and thank you for the email. I shared it with my audience earlier today about how they want to spend up to $1.3 billion or more to get light rail 3 miles down the road and across the river.
Hey, Lars, thanks for taking the call. It was an amazing day. A lot of pushback from the members that were present of the 16 legislators on the committee. An interesting note, only 5 Oregon reps were not present at the meeting, and yet they're talking about the most expensive transportation project in the region's history. But number one, no cost estimates on the revised recommended project will be provided until November. Yet they want the legislators to vote this July. Course number two, you mentioned light rail is now estimated to be $1 billion to $1.3 billion. The Coast Guard earlier this week has communicated that they're about to reject their bridge clearance height of 116 feet because it's too low for the marine traffic.
Absolutely right. John Lee from Clark County. In a moment, how dangerous is Joe Biden's current open border policy? I'll get into that next and your calls. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your calls and emails. If you want to dial into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers always go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can find our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show. And I want to tell you something. I've been talking about immigration issues on this show for more than a quarter of a century, but I never thought that it would get this bad. But as of this month, the United States is now seeing records broken for illegal entry to the United States, which we have never seen before. Almost a quarter of a million illegal aliens came across the border just last month, the month of May alone. And you say, well, that's a big problem. You're right. There are a lot of people coming across the border. And Joe Biden a year ago put Vice President Kamala Harris in charge of it, and she has avoided the border like the plague. And she makes this cockamamie argument that we have to solve the underlying causes of people coming into the country. I'll get to terrorism here in just a moment. But when she talks about the underlying causes, I say, well, here's the cause. If you look at where many of the people from Central and South America are coming from, places like Guatemala, that's a typical place for illegal aliens to come in from. All you have to do is look up What does the average Guatemalan worker make in a year? And the answer is $1,600. That's not per week. That's not per month. That's per year. $1,600 in a year. They're basically making about $140 a month. And you say, well, if they come into America, even if they're working at some of the lowest class jobs in the country, say you're the cleanup guy on a construction crew and your job is to pick up all the construction trash and, you know, clean things up at the end of the workday, that person is going to make more in a month, at least, may make more in a week than he would in Guatemala in a year. So if Kamala Harris says, well, all we have to do is solve the underlying causes, yeah, all we've got to do is change the ratio that in America, a Guatemalan worker can make 20 times as much money in this country as he would at home. So all we have to do is raise wages in Guatemala 20-fold. And I've even put it to people. I said, I don't hear about a lot of Americans who illegally enter another country. And of course, our nearest neighbors, Mexico and Canada, easy enough to go there legally. But if you made, say, $50,000 a year in America, okay, that's a little more than the average. And you found out that if you sneaked into Canada, you could make $1 million a year doing the same kind of work there that you do here. I would imagine there would be some Americans who would say, well, if I can raise my wages for a single year 20-fold by just sneaking into Canada, and Canada doesn't seem to object too much because their current premier, Justin Trudeau, doesn't mind and doesn't really enforce the law as Joe Biden is not enforcing the law, you might be terribly tempted to do that. But I want you to consider something else. Joe Biden's open border policies are making a real danger to America. And here's my specific evidence. The Border Patrol agents, Customs and Border Patrol, nabbed 15 illegal aliens that are listed on the FBI's terror watch list trying to sneak across the U.S.-Mexico border. Now, if you think this is unusual, that this is just people from Mexico, people from Guatemala, from Honduras, from El Salvador, no. Last month, out of that almost 250,000 people who came into America illegally with the aiding and abetting of the Joe Biden presidency and his administration, they came from 161 different countries. That means we've got people coming in from all over the world who've decided America is letting anybody who wants to come in, not America, but Joe Biden specifically, that he's changed all the policies. He's not enforcing the border, even though his Secretary of Homeland Security, Mayorkas, keeps showing up in front of Congress and lying under oath. Members of Congress, even Democrats, will ask him, is the border under control? He'll say, yeah, we have operational control of the border. And that operational control is allowing 250,000 people in 1 month, the month of May, to come into the United States. And among those, people from 161 different countries, including, as I said, at least 15 illegal aliens who are listed on the FBI's terrorist watch list. Now, consider, if we've had 800,000 people so far this year enter the country, we're going to end the year with at least a couple of million people who've come into the country. And just among the ones we catch, because they don't catch, they have getaways or gotaways that are almost equal to the number of the people that they actually intercept. That's the 250,000 I mentioned. Those are the ones Border Patrol actually stops, talks to, writes them a ticket, tells them to show up in court, and then under Joe Biden's rules, simply lets them go into the United States. They do actually run them through the database, but here's what also happens. Customs and Border Patrol will stop a bunch of illegal aliens. They'll run them through their databases. They don't find anything immediately. They let them go. And then a week later, the FBI says, oh, by the way, one of those guys or gals, usually guys, that you let go into America, that guy's on our terrorist watch list, and you just let him go into the United States. Where is he? And of course, they don't know where he is. At the same time, let me bring up a second issue. Do you remember the incident last year when Joe Biden himself dished on the Border Patrol? He doesn't like the Border Patrol. The Border Patrol knows that, but they work for him. And there were some Border Patrol agents who were on horseback. They were trying to manage this gigantic crowd of 10,000 Haitian illegal aliens who had come from Haiti into Mexico, and they were trying to illegally enter in the United States. And Joe Biden, his Border Patrol was there, and the guys on horseback, they were all guys, There's a technique they use where they twirl the reins that they have, the reins that control the horse. And they say it's a way of getting a horse to get going. And you say, why would you need to do that? Well, they said in crowd control situations like the one they were up against, if you have a bunch of people in front of the horse waving their arms and holding packages in their arms or bags in their arms and waving them at the horse is not too terribly crazy about wading into a group of people that are waving their arms at the horse. So the border agent will twirl those reins. Now, this was described because somebody saw a photograph taken by a photographer who even said he didn't see any evidence at all, and he was taking the photo from a short distance away, that any of those reins were used to whip Haitian immigrants. But that was the story. The mainstream media took off with it and said, why there are border agents using their reins to whip at these people, these poor, innocent people trying to come into our country. That was the story they told to America. It was a bald-faced lie. I think they knew it was a lie. And Joe Biden compounded the lie. And he said, these guys are going to be in trouble. Yes, there will be an investigation. But here's a president already predetermining what the outcome of the investigation is going to be. So we've got an out-of-control border. We've got people coming across the border on the FBI terror watch list. We've got literally hundreds of thousands. There will be millions by the end of this year, like there were millions by the end of last year. And Joe Biden is using his, you know, his bully pulpit in the White House to actually trash his own border patrol and say that people will be punished who, by the way, the investigation showed those border agents did absolutely nothing wrong, but Joe Biden decided to trash them anyway. And as the head, the executive who runs all the executive branch agencies, including CBP, he already predetermines the outcome before the investigation has even started. It's just shameful, and America is going to end up paying the price for having an open border and terrorists coming into this country. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday. Your calls are certainly welcome for what we call the best conversation in talk journalism at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers go to the head of the line always at 866-439-5277. You can send emails that come directly to me, talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show or on our website at LarsLarson.com. I wanted to talk to Tom Gipping today, who's the deputy director of the Ed Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, about some very specific issues that we're likely to hear more about after the Supreme Court finally releases its decision in the Dobbs case, which is the what I expect will be the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Tom, welcome back.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, do you have any insights or special connections to tell us why a lot of us, in fact, many people expected the Supreme Court to announce its decision earlier this week, but apparently now we're not going to hear till next week, or I don't know, what's the drop-dead date for the Supreme Court before the justices go on summer break?
I don't have any inside information, although there really wasn't any basis for anyone speculating that it would have been this past week. The Supreme Court's term technically lasts until the beginning of the next one, which is the first Monday in October. But their practice is to issue opinions in all of the cases for this current term by about the end of June. That's their target date. It's not official. It's not a rule or anything. But that's they've stuck pretty consistently to that. And as was the situation with the case of Planned Parenthood versus Casey back in 1992. I was in the Supreme Court room when they handed that down. It was on the last day. So I have assumed that it was going to be on the last day, which would probably be, I guess if I'm looking at the calendar right, 2 weeks from yesterday, maybe. I mean, the last day of June is the 30th. So I'm assuming it's going to be then. It could be earlier, but people have to understand that the end of the line, I mean, it begins with a majority opinion, but the end of the line, when it's ready to go and be announced, that depends on all of the individual opinions, your dissents and all that sort of thing. And that's a long, complicated process.
Is it possible, I mean, I don't know if it's in the practice of the Supreme Court, to say, we realize this one's incendiary. And now we've got the FBI looking into Jane's Revenge, which has targeted a bunch of pregnancy resource centers around the country and claimed credit for domestic terrorist attacks against those PRCs. Could the court be delaying this because they think in some way they'll ameliorate the ultimate reaction when it's released? Or do they usually get into that kind of thing?
No, I certainly don't think they're going to do that. The way that leaked draft opinion was written, and, you know, we've seen that now for over a month, that's a very direct, solid overruling of Roe versus Wade for all the right reasons. It didn't pull any punches. It didn't soft pedal anything. Everyone who joined that opinion, the entire majority, they knew what it would do. And other than having a crystal ball to know exactly, they knew that it would spark a lot of outrage and unrest. So they're going to do their job the way they typically would do it in any other case. They're going to follow their process, and when it's done, they're going to tell us.
Okay. Now, let's get to the states. In blunt terms, does anything really change after the Supreme Court, if we can expect that what they're going to do is overturn Roe v. Wade in Dobbs and Casey, and that it'll no longer be, as the liberals like to say, the law of the land, it'll be up to the laws of the states. But does anything from a practical standpoint change for abortion around America if that happens? Because most of the states have already staked out their positions, haven't they?
Well, many of the states have indicated what they intend to do. They either have laws that predated Roe versus Wade, that it'll take some steps to bring those into effect. Those were never repealed. Or they've passed new laws anticipating that Roe versus Wade would be overruled. The difference, of course, is that, you know, none of those laws could go into effect. As long as Roe versus Wade stood in the way, you know, legislatures could pass any laws they wanted, but they were on hold until the states could actually put them into effect. So it's going to be the biggest difference imaginable, which is real pro-life laws can actually go into effect once Roe versus Wade is gotten rid of.
Now, let's talk about the other direction. I'm talking to Tom Gipping from the Heritage Foundation and at the Ed Meese Center. For those states where elected prosecutors have said, we won't prosecute people even if our state legislature makes procedures, say, past 15 weeks or that sort of thing, illegal, do they have the legal authority to do something like that, to simply say we're going to effectively, you know, I guess on a local level, practice Roe v. Wade, even when Roe v. Wade has been thrown out?
Well, that's the right way to put it. I think as a technical matter, prosecutors decide which cases to go after and which not. So they do have discretion in a general way. But that discretion is about individual cases. It's about the facts and the law, you know, involving an individual case. What's happening here is you have prosecutors saying, we're going to ignore an entire category of laws. We don't care what the individual cases are. We disagree with these laws. We think the legislature shouldn't have passed them, and we're going to, in a sense, go on strike when it comes to the pro-life laws. That's a completely different matter, and that's what people should be outraged about, because we elect the executive branch of government. We elect prosecutors to enforce the law. They're supposed to do that impartially, to make objective judgments about, you know, evidence in which cases to prosecute. But they're not supposed to push legislators aside and pretend as if they're in control of what the law is.
Yeah,
we can't have that. And that's going to be a big challenge going forward.
Now, the last issue, and this is, I've heard the idea floated, that the White House is now talking about, is there a way for the president to sign an executive order declaring a public health emergency, is the kind of language you're hearing around this, where the president, not the Congress, would say, I'm declaring a public health emergency and abortion will be available, and effectively override state law? I don't know if you've heard those same reports.
I have not heard of that idea, but there is no conceivable basis by which the president could do that. The bases on which such declarations must be made are well-defined, and there isn't any conceivable way that that criminalizing a practice which was criminal for two centuries in America now suddenly becomes a public health crisis. No, that's absolutely not going to happen.
I mean, I only ask it because I also thought it was crazy when the president said, I'm going to make all these people get vaccinated, and the courts had to shut him down on that. So it's not like asking, could Joe Biden do something that doesn't actually fit in with the Constitution
right.
or the law?
No,
well, let's see, he's
right.
done it.
You're right about that, but you've identified the difference here. You know, the vaccinations were in the context of, obviously, a deadly virus, protecting human life in the womb, which the Supreme Court, even in Roe versus Wade, said is a legitimate and important interest of government, is a completely different matter. That's maybe a little bit creative, but it's also really desperate.
Well, I certainly
hope. Once Roe versus Wade is gone, we can protect unborn children, and we're going to do it.
Do you have any doubt it's going to be what was in the draft opinion when it is released?
All of the circumstances point to that conclusion, that they're going to overrule Roe and Casey, that they're going to do it in the way that draft opinion presents. I do believe that's what's going to happen,
okay.
And it's long overdue, and I think we should all applaud the Supreme Court for correcting a really grave error.
I couldn't agree with you more. Tom Gipping with us. You got the Lars Larson Show. That's right. They do at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. Go to NickShivers.com for details. Our Twitter poll today, now that the FDA has authorized it, will you vax your kids as young as 6 months? I don't have any kids that are 6 months of age and older. Well, I have some adult kids, but they make their own decisions. Do I think that's a smart thing for parents to do? I think you should carefully consider the risks posed by COVID and whether or not your child might become infected, and the risks posed by the vaccine. Now, it's very rarely put that way in mainstream media reports, but every single thing you do in life, it has to be weighing one risk versus another risk. The Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Since it's a First Amendment Friday, Randy, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Well, first off, you're just like a fine wine down there. You guys just keep getting better and better and better as time goes on.
Well, you're so generous.
What's on my
Thank
mind
you.
is we can't forget our past like they want us to. I know you remember when they talked about peak oil 15 years ago. Maybe it's 20 now. Time flies.
Oh,
remember
Jimmy
that?
Carter.
Peak oil,
Jimmy,
peak oil,
hold on,
red
Randy,
oil.
Randy, Randy, what? Take it back farther. Jimmy Carter was telling us we were going to be out of oil by the 1990s. And he was telling us that in the early 1970s. And I love to use him as the benchmark to say, who was predicting we'd be out? Jimmy Carter. When did he predict it? In the 70s. When did he say we'd be out of oil? The 90s. By the 90s, we had more known proven reserves of oil, even after decades of using a lot of oil every year, about 20 million barrels a day. For decades and decades, Jimmy Carter was just flat dead wrong. And so, you know, the left still talks about peak oil today, saying we've peaked out, we've run out of oil. And now they don't say it anymore much, Randy, because they know that we've got massive amounts of proven reserves. And can I tell you one thing? A few years ago, I had a guy on from one of the big oil companies. I don't have any special ties to the oil companies other than what I spend at the pumps to fill up our cars. But I had this guy on, and I said, hey, you had this massive new find, like 1.5 billion barrels. I said, can you describe where that well is? He says, sure, it's easy. He said, have you ever seen the movie And There Will Be Blood, which is actually a very dark movie, but a very good movie, you know, and it was about oil drilling. I said, yeah, I've seen the movie. It's based on a true story. He said, remember the big find that guy had where they were drilling with really primitive equipment and everything else, but they tapped into this huge reservoir of oil. I said, yeah. He says, well, the one we found is under that one, you know, like a couple of miles under the earth. And I said, so there was more oil there. The guy just didn't know it. And he said, yeah. I said, does anybody know what our total overall capacity or ability to find oil is? He says, nobody knows for sure.
Right. And another thing that these scientists that know so much, they're wrong all the time. When I was a youngster back in the early 70s when we had the second worst, Jimmy Carter, I remember an article, I remember as a little kid, and I think it was the Atlantic maybe, but it talked about how all the people in the Horn of Africa are going to freeze to death. We need to get them out of there before they all freeze. And it's just, I'm just saying that these people, they mean well, but they really aren't as smart as they seem to be or we accept. And the other thing is, just, I wanted to say really quick, I was thinking about the Supreme Court justice. I don't know why. But, man, she doesn't even remember when during the hearing she said I'm on the board of directors, but I don't know what goes on at the school. I mean, how's she going to do
that? You're talking about Ketanji Brown Jackson. Yeah. So she's on the board of directors, right, of a very expensive private school, costs almost $50,000 a year to send your kids there. And she's on the board of directors. And when they asked her, well, are they teaching CRT in schools? And she said no. And then the senator, who apparently knew more about the school than she did as a board member, said, well, they're teaching it at the school that you're on the board of directors for. And she said, oh, I'm just on the board of directors. I don't know what's actually going on at the school. That's a person that we're going to have on the U.S. Supreme Court not too very long from now. Randy, thanks for the call. Let's go to Robert. Hey, Robert, it's First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. I'd like to talk about illegal immigration for a second.
Sure.
Apparently right now the Democrats are really dropping the ball. And it's my opinion both Democrats and Republicans are initially or partially to blame for the problem. Immigration has been a problem for years now, and neither one of the parties has really stepped up with any effective approach to this problem. I would suggest a four-part solution that I've kind of come up with. I'll go over it real quick.
Let's hear it.
Number one would be stop the attraction. Go after the companies that actually hire the illegals and fine them or up to and losing their business if they continue. Number two would be allow seasonal and other special exemptions with restrictions, like not staying all year if they do come in for a partial time. Number three would be no benefits from government, no driver's license, and with expulsion and no chance for future citizenship if they get caught. Number four would be eliminate the anchor babies and limit the family members allowed to be brought in the future. Now, all of these require fine-tuning, of course, but that's the concept.
Robert, can I tell you that every single thing you mentioned except the anchor baby change is already in place right now? It's already in law. It's already in place. It's been law for decades. It depends on who you have in the White House and whether or not he'll enforce the law. Every one of the first three items you mentioned is already the law in the United States. Joe Biden refuses to enforce it. Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't as stressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours? Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits, at least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on this First Amendment Friday. Your phone calls and your emails are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, I'd be lying to you if I told you there's never been an occasion where I've been at a public event and people come up to ask questions of me afterwards, and it's a compliment to say, well, we care about what you think about this. Jill Biden, apparently, Dr. Jill Biden, the president's spouse, apparently is not as tolerant of that these days because she realizes what an idiot her husband makes of himself when he tries to explain that inflation and rising gas prices are not really his problem. So literally today, she was anxious for him and for her to get off to their beach house in Delaware. So she finally said, hey, guys, we've got to go. And she basically put the hook on her husband, which I think is absolutely stunning. I mean, you give a lot of latitude to first ladies, but in this case, she doesn't want her husband answering questions because she knows he doesn't have the answers. Now, I figure one of the guys who does have the answers is Joe Kent, retired Special Forces warrant officer and now running to replace the Rhino Republican Jamie Herrera Butler in Washington's 3rd Congressional District. I've endorsed Joe. I expect that if everything goes as it should be after this fall's election, Jamie is out, Joe is in, and Joe, what do we need to do right now? Because there are a lot of families out there who are being bankrupted by these gas prices, food prices, and all these other forms of inflation. I don't think they can wait till November.
No, I don't think they can, Lars. Thanks for having me on, as always. I mean, sure. Right now, the American people, especially the people of this district, are absolutely being crushed with the gas prices, inflation. And the horrible thing is our ruling class, whether it's sending money off to billions of dollars off to Ukraine every time Zelensky asks us for more cash, or whether it's Joe Biden saying, hey, we have to get going because it's a long weekend for us in Delaware, our ruling class doesn't seem to care whatsoever. So when we take power, and we're going to have a red wave, I mean, we just have to make sure the red wave is ready to fight. So on day one, we have to very plainly say to the Biden administration that we will not sign off on the federal budget until you reverse all of your day one energy policies and restore the Trump energy policies. Because if Biden wants to choke the American people every single day at the gas pump, well, that's fine. We'll choke off the funding for the federal government.
I think that's a good way to get the message across. Cut the budget off. Because, Joe, you and I both know that the president's spokeswoman, this Karine Jean-Pierre, who seems to be way over her head, she was asked about, you know, gas prices. And she said, well, these oil companies, all we need them to do is refine the oil they already have. And you think, does this woman have a clue? She's speaking for the president of the United States, and she seems to think that oil companies at stratospheric prices are saying, let's hold the oil back a little while longer. We've got it. We just don't want to turn it into gasoline and sell it at the highest prices we've ever had in American history.
No, I mean, it's literal, no pun intended, I guess. It's literal gaslighting. I mean, they're saying that, hey, this is either because of Vladimir Putin, or they're saying that it's the oil companies that are being conducting price gouging, or they're being greedy, or they just need to refine more oil faster. Like, none of it makes sense. What they do is they just throw a barrage of words at people and expect us to just nod along because the media in general is so complacent with them. And then also you throw in the fact that they'll say that this is the first ever, whatever, African-American homosexual that's up there on the PR stage, and so therefore we all automatically have to go along with that whatever she says. So they've done a brilliant job, I think, of really throwing their propaganda up front with the woke ideology, so that you can't question. You're not supposed to be able to question how terrible the policies are.
You know, isn't it amazing, Joe? I want to bring up this young lady, Myra, down in Texas, who is doing the same thing you're doing. She's running to be in the U.S. Congress. She won the primary in a district that I think has been a Democrat district, believe it or not, in Texas since the 1800s. And she won. And, you know, she's notable because she would be the first female born in Mexico to become an American citizen and go to the U.S. Congress. Now, I don't really care about all these, you know, first lesbian, first black, first white, first whatever. But in this case, the mainstream media is avoiding that story like the plague. So the very rules they'd apply saying, well, this is the first this or the first that, they don't apply it to her at all because she has an R for Republican in front of her name.
That's right. There's that factor. They definitely don't want to give any credit to, you know, any of their protected groups. They try and say that have been systemically discriminated against. They don't want to give any credit to any of those folks who happen to be Republicans. But I think also what they don't want to talk about is why she got elected, why it was a Hispanic woman in a district in Texas. They don't want to point out the fact that their immigration policies, the left's immigration policies of open borders, it's absolutely crushing the working class. And in Texas, a lot of the working class is Hispanic. And the Democrats really think that they own the minority vote at every single level and the working class vote, but they're losing that because their policies are crushing the working class.
You know, it's really crazy, Joe. I'll throw you one. I don't know if you want to use it in a speech or not. The latest idea the White House has floated out is gasoline rebate cards. And I thought, hold on, does anybody understand what's going on here? Gas prices are too high because of what the White House did. And now the White House says, I'll tell you what, we'll borrow some money in your name, Joe, and then we'll send a card to you that has the money on it, and you can use it to pay the extraordinary gas prices that we caused to begin with. It would be like you saying, Lars, I can't afford a tank of gas. They say, hey, Joe, hand me your credit card. I'll get you a tank of gas. And then I use your credit card to buy you a tank of gas. And you ask me, how did that put me ahead? You just put a purchase I couldn't afford on my credit card. And I say, yeah, but you won't see it for a while, or maybe your kids and grandkids will pay it off for you. That's what they're down to at the White House. They're scraping to the bottom of the barrel.
That's exactly right. And again, they just think that we're so dumb that we're not going to see what this is, that this is a, you know, three card Monte, a sleight of hand. But then also, I think this is really trying to condition people. We already got some conditioning during COVID lockdowns that your job could be taken away and the government would just send you income. And now they're saying, okay, there's a shortage of commodity action. Right now it's fuel. And so therefore the government will parachute in and essentially hand you a card, a ration card. And so the government controls, you know, now the means of production, they control the capital. And this is going to be the solution. They want to condition us, I think, to this centralized system. COVID was a part of that. The Great Reset's part of that. This is everything that the left is doing has this eventual endgame. They really fear sovereignty. They really fear independence.
And you know what they want? They want guaranteed annual income. They want every American to say, well, I get the first 10, 12, 20 grand from the government, and then whatever I work beyond that is what I get. That's the system they have in Cuba right now. You get a stipend every month. It'll barely keep you going, but it comes from the government, so you better not cross the government because they control your basic income.
That's right, and you link that with how pervasive big tech is right now and the big push, especially that we had here in Washington State for a vaccine, a digital vaccine passport. I mean, that's what's coming around the corner next is some form of a social credit score and the government just allocating you what they feel that your labor is worth. That's really these people's aim. It's incredibly dangerous and must be stopped.
Joe, remind folks of your website, please.
JoeKentForCongress.com.
Very good. That's Joe Kent. He's running to replace Jaime Herrera Butler, the Rhino Republican in name only, who currently occupies the 3rd Congressional District. And by the way, we keep inviting Jaime to come back on the program. She's been here plenty of times before. And there was a time I was enthusiastic about her. Not so much lately, especially after that impeachment vote. In a moment, do skirts in schools violate the constitutional rights of students? We'll get to that and your calls on a First Amendment Friday. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on a First Amendment Friday. I'm always glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. Now, this next story kind of hit me close to home because it made me think of my granddaughter, who's currently in kindergarten. She'll be in first grade next year. And she has to wear a uniform to school. And I've always been in favor of school uniforms. Now, maybe if you asked me in high school, I would have said, no, I don't want to wear a uniform and dress like everybody else. But as an adult, I can look at that and say, number one, it's probably less expensive overall for parents to have their kids in uniforms. You go out and buy three or four variations of them. One goes in the laundry, two are on the hanger, one is on the kid, and you just rotate them. It makes it very easy. Number two, it means that all the usual nonsense that people get about you're not wearing the right kind of sneakers, the right kind of Nikes, the right kind of Pumas, and you're wearing the kind of jeans that aren't popular or a color that doesn't fit well with other people. You have all the kids in uniforms, and it is exactly what it says, uniform. Nothing wrong with it at all, except there is now a court decision. I hope this one gets overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. And it seems very strange because I whittled it down to this. Do skirts in schools for girls violate the constitutional rights of students? There's this charter school in North Carolina. Now, charter schools, you should understand, are public schools. That is, they're open to everyone. They're funded by the taxpayers, and every parent can seek to have his or her child in a charter school. And I've explained this to people because charter schools, when they first hit, people had a tough time understanding, well, is it a public school? Yes. Is my child allowed to go there? Yes. Do the taxpayers pay the tab? Yes. Yes to all of those things. After that, charter schools can be a thousand different things. In fact, there was a charter school a few years ago that I was really impressed by, because I know that not every kid is into the academic side of school. So they actually wrapped this charter school idea around the idea of bicycles. And, you know, I know there are people who think I'm against bicycles. I'm not. I'm against the spandex mafia, people who ride bicycles and think the rules do not apply to them. But what they wrapped this around was something I liked to do as a kid. I would take bikes apart. I'd take go-karts apart. And they got kids interested in the engineering of bicycles, in all the various aspects. So you can imagine how math works into that. Shop class works into that. Vocational schools work. Vocational skills work into that. Well, this school in North Carolina requires its students, the female students, to wear skirts. And apparently, this is what seems strange to me. If you have a school that's voluntary for you to go through, you can go to a conventional government school and your kid can dress any way they want. Because I don't know of a single public school other than the charters where they say you need to wear a uniform. So the parents of this child brought a lawsuit, and they've taken it all the way up to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, Virginia. And what they've said, their basic case is that the charter school violates female students' constitutional rights by requiring that they wear skirts. And guess what? A federal court has actually agreed with that idea. It was a 10-6 ruling because this was apparently en banc. It was all the judges in the Fourth Circuit Court, U.S. Court of Appeals. They said the dress code at the charter day school in Leland, North Carolina, blatantly perpetuates harmful gender stereotypes. Now, hold on a second. I know that my little granddaughter, who I mentioned, she loves skirts and dresses. She also wears pants from time to time. But she loves dresses. Why would you have your kid, first of all, go to a charter school if you understand day one when you go in and inquire and say, my daughter would like to go to school here. Okay, she needs to understand that there is a requirement for uniforms. The school, quote, according to the court, has imposed the skirt requirement with the express purpose of telegraphing to children that girls are fragile and that they require protection by boys and warrant different treatment than male students, stereotypes with potentially devastating consequences for young girls. Boy, what a disaster that sounds like. Do you think that when your daughter, or if you're young enough, your sister in school, wears a dress, that she's sending the message that she's weak and fragile and needs to be protected by boys? Not that I think there's anything wrong with boys protecting girls. That sounds like a good idea to me. Girls protecting boys? Well, if they get the opportunity, sure. The charter day school, quote, does not attempt to disguise the true and improper rationale behind its differential treatment of girls. That's what one of the senior judges wrote, a young lady. The ruling was the first time that a federal appeals court has recognized that charter schools receiving public funds are subject to the same safeguards, as traditional public schools. That, according to, of course, the usual suspects over the ACLU, the American Crooks and Lawyers Union. Aaron Street, the lawyer representing the charter day school, said the school is looking into potential next steps after the erroneous ruling. Now, I do know from lawyers I've talked to, it costs $50,000 or $100,000 to be able to take a case and even apply to have the case heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. I kind of hope this one is. Does this mean, if you take the logical extension of this argument, if by telling girls you're wearing a skirt, that means you're weak and fragile and you have to be protected by boys, does that mean that if boys are allowed to wear pants, or say required to wear uniform pants, I would guess that unless you're wearing a Scottish kilt, you're going to be wearing pants to school if you're a young man. So we're telling young men, you are the stronger, you are expected to protect young ladies, and that we are suggesting that to you by the way that you dress. Look, there are plenty of powerful women in all parts of society, politics and everywhere else, who are strong, powerful women, no matter what they're wearing. You know, and so this kind of argument that says, if a charter school says we want a uniform look to our students. As I said, I think it solves all kinds of problems. It is more thrifty for most parents. I mean, some parents would object to it, but I guess they'd send their kids to school in hand-me-downs. But if you are buying regular school clothes for your kids, the popular jeans, the popular shoes, the popular shirts, and in a great variety, I would imagine in almost every case that's going to cost you more money to equip your kids for school. Secondly, when they get to school, they can focus on what they're there for, which is learning, not who's wearing the right kind of shoes or who's wearing the most popular kind of dress or the shirt that has the right logo on it. Everybody dresses the same because you're there to do one thing, and that thing is learn. And I don't think in any way, shape, or form that having girls wear skirts to school is communicating that they're not powerful. You understand that in world history, about half of the governments, if you go back thousands of years, half of them were matriarchies, not patriarchies. Although, don't get into that conversation with a liberal progressive because it'll make their head explode. So just a fair warning on that. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go to the head of the line on the Lars Larson Show. You can send emails to me, talk@LarsLarson.com, and be sure to vote in our Twitter poll. Find it at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. And if you feel like it, tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I confess to you that I watched and listened to the entire first evening of the big Democrat January 6th committee. I've watched big parts of it since then. And I'll tell you something, my conclusion is there's a reason that they don't have much attention from the general public. They got a little boost because the first night was put on in prime time on all the major networks. And shortly after that, the Democrats seemed to realize we didn't put a smoking gun out there because we don't have one. And the public, we're losing very quickly. I think Andy Biggs knows that. He's the member of Congress from Arizona who represents Arizona's 5th Congressional District. And he's also head of the Border Security Caucus, which we're going to really need after Joe Biden loses the House and the Senate this fall. Congressman, good to have you back.
Lars, good to be with you. Thanks.
I mean, should I be glad that the Democrats have decided to make this a kangaroo court with selected members, as you pointed out, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, types like that, as opposed to having some real questions asked by Republicans? Because they seem to walk themselves right into a corner. No smoking gun. They're even, it sounds like they're not even going to make a referral to the DOJ because they realize that's problematic as well. So does this thing all just peter out at some point, or do they keep banging the drum till November?
Well, I mean, I've got mixed thoughts on that because I think that they're going to keep banging the drum till November because, I mean, you got guys on that committee that still believe that Unicorn's going to be riding in with a Russian hoax evidence that Mueller said doesn't exist. So I think they're going to keep doing that. But I think they're doing irreparable harm to not just the two-party system, which I think is really, really in trouble now, but I think to the institution itself, if they were self-aware or self-reflective, they would step back and say, "Well, okay, enough's enough. We've made our point. We think Donald Trump's a criminal, and everybody who supports him is bad, and let's move on." But that's not where they're going to go.
No, and Congressman, I think I know you pretty well, but I'll call you Congressman instead. I don't want to call you Andy.
You call me Andy.
I appreciate it because I like the work you do and I like the stuff you write. But one of the biggest problems they've got is the logical question is, if you think Trump's a criminal, why don't you make a referral to the DOJ? Except they seem to have realized that over at the DOJ, they've actually charged half a dozen people with seditious conspiracy, except that all of those cases say Trump was not involved in driving the conspiracy. So if they send a referral and say, please charge Donald Trump with a crime, Merrick Garland's going to say, well, we've already got half a dozen cases where you say he's not involved. You know, he's involved in the sense that he was president, but he's not involved in planning or pushing or promoting the conspiracy. So we can't very well walk into one court and tell the judge Donald Trump is the guy who drove all this, and in the other court tell the judge Donald Trump wasn't really involved at all. These guys all just came up with it on their own. So they won't make the referral, And yet the logical question, even from the left-wing media, should be, well, if you think he's a criminal, ask that the DOJ charge him. And they won't have a good answer to that, will they?
No, they won't. You're exactly right. So when I see Vinnie Thompson puts out a thing saying, we're not going to refer anything to DOJ, even Raskin has said, well, you know, it's not our job to make a referral. But Liz Cheney says they're going to make a referral. The problem is some of these people are doing this for personal animus against the president. Others because they just have a bad political feeling towards the president, disagree with him. But the bottom line is, you could make a referral to DOJ. You could, or you could lay out everything you have in a finding and give it to them. But they're not in shape to do it. And just watching, I'm kind of watching like you are. I watch most of that first one. It was a yawn fest. The one last night, yesterday, didn't seem really provocative either. And I was trying to catch it between meetings. They promised something that they cannot deliver on, and it's all done because they want to put Donald Trump in jail. That is their goal. But they don't have the constitutional authority or the capacity to act as criminal investigators.
No, they don't. But they do have the authority to say to the DOJ, please charge him. So at this point, aren't we left with something where even Joe Biden's FBI last summer came out and said, we've looked at it. No, the president did not drive what happened on January mm-hmm. the 6th. That's Joe Biden's FBI in Joe Biden's DOJ. And then the questions that aren't being asked, Congressman, are the ones that really bother me. Why is it Nancy Pelosi was offered up to 20,000 National Guard troops 4 days before January 6th and turned them down? And why did the Capitol Police turn it down? Why did Washington, D.C. turn it down? And if Donald Trump was really trying for an insurrection to take over the government, why would he say put 10,000 or up to 20,000 National Guard over there? Because it would be self-defeating, wouldn't it? And yet all of that is not being asked. What the FBI says, they warned the Capitol cops. Did the Capitol cops tell Nancy Pelosi, who runs the Capitol cops? You know, how about some of those questions? Are we ever going to get those questions asked?
I hope we're going to get those questions asked, but it's not going to happen until next January when Republicans take over and start asking those questions, because I'm like you. Everything you said, I said, why did Vinnie Thompson, the chairman of this committee, say Nancy Pelosi's off limits? Why did he not bring in the sergeant at arms who made these decisions? Why is he not bringing in Muriel Bowser, who was offered and said no to these? Why not bring in Chuck Schumer? Because they know what these people are going to say, because it's out there. They said, we don't want the National Guard here because of optics, which is a political decision, not a security decision. So,
and it was a dumb one.
It was a dumb decision. I think a deterrent. That's what 15,000 National Guard troops would have been around the Capitol. That would have been a deterrent. And since what they've produced for seditious, they've actually charged a total of 11 people with sedition, and they were the ones that actually caused some rioting violence. Well, you know what? That's very, very different from the insurrection narrative that the Democrats have been laying down to the American people for 18 months. And quite frankly, they're lucky that more people aren't watching it and getting more disgusted with what the Democrats have said happened vis-a-vis what the evidence is actually producing.
Congressman, I think you know I'm not a big conspiracy theorist, but my theory all along has been Pelosi wanted things to go wrong that day because that gave her the predicate for an impeachment that we all agree was wrong. And the Senate found Donald Trump not guilty, acquitted him, but they needed to have an excuse to do this. And I think that's why they turned down the help. They said, we need this to happen because we'll be able to use it. And they did.
Well, so much. I used to be like you. I used to say, well, it's really not conspiratorial. Not purposeful. But I look at it and I say, virtually every bad policy since Joe Biden has been around and winning that election, becoming the president, it looks to me that like it's almost all purposeful, whether it's the border issue, whether it's the rioting in the Capitol. And they like power, Lars. They love power. And it's really a shame, but I tend to think that people who love power so much will say and do darn near anything to get and keep power.
Yeah, I mean, I once believed that it was just what Obama said. Never, you know, never underestimate Joe's ability to F things up. But actually, mm-hmm. I don't know if you could accidentally F up as much of America as Joe Biden has managed to mess up. I'm with you. I think that this is purposeful and that they are destroying the country for a reason. That's Congressman Andy Biggs from Arizona's 5th Congressional District. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get right to your calls. It's a First Amendment Friday at 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on a First Amendment Friday. Let me get to your calls. I mentioned that story about a charter school that required young ladies to wear dresses to school. And they've now been taken to court, and the court has decided that dresses make young ladies appear fragile and in need of protection from young men. So who better to comment on that than Caitlin? Caitlin, I'm guessing that you're a student. Would you mind telling us?
Yes, I am a student.
How old are you, young lady?
I'm 15.
15. See, now, when you're in your 20s, I'm not allowed to ask ladies their age anymore. So that's okay. I guess I dodged that one. So tell me what you think about a school that would say you have to wear a uniform. In the case of young ladies, it's a skirt.
So I disagree with the skirt and the dresses making you seem weak, but I also feel like girls should have the choice between skirts and pants because some girls feel uncomfortable in like skirts and dresses and stuff like that.
I think that's fair. I know that I cited my granddaughter, who's only 6, but she gets the choice not of a skirt, but a skort. And I had to learn what that was. And she can wear pants to school as well, because on cold days, it's more the practicality of them. But do you think that it violates somebody's constitutional rights to have the school set any kind of dress code like that?
I feel like dress code does for like colors or like certain like shirts and stuff like that doesn't matter, but like I think that doesn't violate any rights. But as for skirts versus pants or shorts, I feel like we should have the right to choose.
There you go. The right. Now, that's one where I could actually endorse the right to choose. Caitlin, thank you very much, and good luck to you in your education.
Thank you. You too.
Glad to have you on. Mike writes in, Lars, I am simple-minded, and that's why I like my theories. The Democrats put all their chips on the red 45 and spun the wheel. If they could get part of the insurrection to stick, they could block my guy Donald from holding office in the future. I guess it was worth a try. Except for the fact that they knew when they impeached him the second time, they knew he wasn't going to be convicted. And even if they got Merrick Garland of the DOJ to bring a formal criminal charge, they can't even get enough in front of people to keep people's interest right now. Do you really think that Merrick Garland's attorneys could go to the courts and make a case beyond a reasonable doubt, which is what a criminal charge requires, and be able to sell that to a jury or a judge? I don't see it happening. Let's go to Ann. Hey, Ann, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, I have two views on this school uniform thing.
Right.
Of course, I'm dating myself, but when we started going to school and of course, the boys were riding bicycles, girls wanted to ride bicycles, too. Do you know what those stupid bicycle chains that used to break so easily would do to your ankles if you didn't have pants to protect you?
No doubt. No doubt. I can imagine.
Well, anyway, that was one of the reasons that I got my parents to give up on the frilly dress that they thought I should wear because I was a girl to go to school. So I finally got to wear the pants. But I think pants are an excellent idea. And as far as school uniforms go, they don't have to be a solid color. My grandson went to school and the clothes were plaids.
Plaids.
You choose
all
any
plaids?
One of those plaids to put your jacket, your skirt, your pants, you know, any one of the plaid colors that were designated in their uniform fabric.
And the thing that floors me, though, is the parents. The parents who would take their child to a school where they're told your child has to wear a uniform and then object to wearing the uniform. That's the part that floors me. If you don't want your kid to wear a uniform, don't send your kid to a school. Don't choose a school that requires a uniform. Is that reasonable?
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. It's a rather stupid parent to bring a case like that.
I couldn't agree with you more. Anne, thank you very much. Let's go to Brian. Hey, Brian, it's First Amendment Friday. Everything's fair game. What's on your mind today?
Well, good evening, Lars. Thank you very much for having me on the show. I think that you provide a great service to the community.
You're too kind.
Basically, what I was thinking about is that if you really look at the crux of the issue here, at the end of the day, if you're going to a school, you're going to an educational program where you say, I'm going to place my child into a private school or a charter school, this is going to better their education. They're going to have more of a chance of going to college at this point. They're going to have a better life. And one of the caveats is you have to wear a uniform. I think that that's okay. I think that requiring our students to follow direction, learn how the world works, that's great. But everything's become so political now in our society. So I think that if you really look at the crux of the issue, I think that because everything's so politicized, because everything's so political now, I think that the down and dirty issue here is that masculinity is really under attack in our nation.
Oh, and, I agree.
I appreciate that. I really do. And I think that it's okay to say there's a difference between being male and female. I myself grew up in a household with a very strong male role model who was great for me. I went to the Boy Scouts for 12 years. I became an Eagle Scout, did great things in the Boy Scouts. And then let's flash back a few years ago. The Boy Scouts was under attack because it's a male organization. Hey, the Boy Scouts, they deserve to fall. They're doing all these things wrong. And at the end of the day, whenever there's an issue that's gender-based and there's something that people can sink their teeth into, that's what's happening.
It is exactly what's happening. And notice what's happening to a lot of young men who don't have a father figure in the home. Sometimes they go seriously, even sometimes fatally wrong.